I actually came up with a great idea. And so basically, and this will help the AC fund the assembly. If you're going to vote, you have to bring singles, dollar bills. And so everybody's got to bring like 50 of them, right? And then what you do is you have three money counters up there. And you have yes is one money counter, and no is one money counter, and abstain is one money counter. Welcome to the long-awaited Grace at the Gates General Assembly summary and update. The 53rd General Assembly in 2026 of the PCA. Here's the update. Now, usually my podcast under the Presbyterian Reformed Churchman would do this at General Assembly. It was kind of like fun to be the first one out. And I often would cover like every major decision. And sometimes I would say top 10 things that happened at GA or top 20 things. And I'm not doing that this year. So if you're looking for that, you know, I recommend to you either the Polity Matters guys or the Westminster Standard podcast. And Ryan Beasy at GA did just that. He had Mel Duncan on and Jackson Lynn, the new rising star in the PCA. 2 years in a row, Jackson had these really cool speeches that were a blessing to all of us. So I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go through all the decisions and all that. I'm going to basically look at this General Assembly and give an overall summary impression of it through the lens of the four major controversial topics that everybody anticipated coming into the GA. And to that regard, I entitled this GA, the Status Quo Big Tent General Assembly. And right now I have people on both sides of the denomination upset with me, because if you're on the more progressive missional side, you know that guys on the conservative confessional side, you know, like kind of use that pejoratively, big tent. Guys on the confessional side are don't like to hear about that generally. And I don't mean it pejoratively. I just mean it reflects, this General Assembly clearly to me reflected our big tent identity and that we are going to keep things as they are for now. And that doesn't mean nothing happened during the General Assembly. Clearly lots of good business happens. Things don't have to become law or debated or discussed to say that good things happened. We have to review presbytery records. We have to do all kinds of things. We elected a new stated clerk and Fred Greco and all those things. So there's things that happened, but for the most part, things were decided and the assembly progressed to maintain the status quo. That's my impression of it. Other General Assemblies were dubbed the, you know, the Side B or Revoice General Assembly. A couple of years ago, we had the Review and Control General Assembly, where it seemed like that was the pervading theme, that those groups that were in charge of overseeing committees or decisions or review of presbytery records were exercising their review and then control. This one is the status quo. That's my assessment, to maintain the big tent identity. And that's not a judgment, I don't think. I think you can take that for however you want it. I think that's just what happened. And the way I see this is because coming into this year, particularly like a couple months ago, all the talk was on four major issues, controversies really, but issues. The two AIC or ad interim committee reports that were reported to both produce a report and be discussed at this assembly. The FFO controversy, functional female officers, that had the online world all up in arms. And the MNA uncovering of a number of the issues that they're working through and fixing. And so that's how I want to go through this report, rather than talk about all the decisions, to talk about what happened with these things and what that kind of means for the PCA and the direction that we're going. And also at the end of this, I may talk of some structural things for the assembly itself or thoughts that I have. So we'll just go through these things. So like I said, the Directory of Public Worship, the Christian Nationalism Report, functional female officers, and M&A. And let's start with M&A. This is great news, honestly. I think, you know, like a lot was uncovered with how finances were handled, and they're still dealing with that. They're still looking at that. In a lot of cases, they couldn't tell us what they know yet, but they promised they're going to tell us next year. And for the most part, people were accepting of that because they realized that whatever happened in the past is being dealt with now. And the trajectory, the vision, the identity, the culture of M&A, like it's been acknowledged that there were things that had to be worked through, and they're being worked through. And so thanks to Steve Dowling for that. And it just really showed me a great vote of confidence. But, and this will be a theme of all four of the things, everything basically got punted to next year. It was a punt. Punt till next year, status quo. And the part that got punted, but they had to, and I'm not, again, this is not pejorative or critical or anything. They had to. Legally, they have to wait another year to tell us what they know. They're still uncovering what they know. Very, very happy about M&A. I'm wearing, again, a disaster response shirt to stand in unity, solidarity with the great people that work in M&A disaster response that serves our denomination and the people in the areas where they serve so very well. Steve Dowling's report, he got cut off because there's just too many good things to share in the midst of, you know, the various either financial or cultural things that were being uncovered with M&A. And he's the man for the job. It's just remarkable. So real blessing to know Steve, but that he's a gift to the PCA. Okay. The Directory of Public Worship, amazingly, they got the whole thing done in 1 year. And the authors of that were going on podcasts and talking about it. And as they were doing that, they were getting feedback. And the whole thing was we were going to be voting on it at this General Assembly. I'm not clear. I think originally they were going to submit it to the Assembly, maybe had to go to overtures, but I could be completely wrong on that. And then it was basically said, no, this is going to just be for information and we'll present it next year and we'll take feedback. So in a sense, that kind of got punted to next year. But the benefit of that is that presbyteries and churches can read it and individuals and give feedback to the committee. I think it's going to be so tough for them because this report, as it stood in its finished form, reflected our big tent identity of the PCA. It didn't forbid really much of anything. It didn't require much of anything. I think it was said like they used a lot of shoulds, but not that many shalls, but they said, well, there were still shalls in there. And when I looked at the report, the shalls mostly were around things that shall be said by the minister during like giving of vows or officiating the Lord's Supper or such. So the there were shalls, but it was, well, shall say this. So as opposed to these worship services shall have these things. I don't know. It was met with mixed reviews. It was written very devotionally, but at the end of the day, it won't be dealt with until next year. And it'll be interesting to see what is changed and if it's even easy to figure out what was changed from this year's. So then to the Christian Nationalism report. Now that one was one similarly that I didn't think would be ready in a year. What ended up happening is it was called a partial report. They wanted time to do the appendices, which would support much of their work. But David Strain, who was the chair of this committee, reported that there, you know, there was an error or errors in it and maybe some things that needed to be cleaned up or corrected. My thought was, why are we sending down a report for consideration and use that we're saying has errors that will be cleaned up and a final form will come next year? I mean, and what I said in my speech was this is a de facto adoption because we're telling presbytery, the assembly is voting to tell presbyteries to use this. So I made a substitute motion to, it was viewed as an amendment. Mel Duncan called it the Sayor Amendment, which was everybody got a kick out of, or some people got a kick out of, and that's what it'll be called by me from now on, the Sayer Amendment, was to send down for consideration and use just the pastoral letter of this partial report.
So before the assembly is recommendation one. That's found on page 2704 in your commissioner's handbook. That simply states that the material that the committee has pulled together, the excellent material under Dr. Strain's leadership, be made available to the sessions and presbyteries and interested parties for their consideration and use. That is the matter before the assembly. Is there any debate? Help me. Microphone one, for what purpose do you rise?
I'd like to make a substitute motion.
All right, I believe a substitute motion is in order. We will receive that.
George Sayer, Ministry to State Florida, Gulf Coast Presbytery. To that motion, I'd like to add three words. Would you like me to give you the motion?
Is there a second? Okay, proceed.
Okay. That the assembly make the, these are the three words I'd like to add, so that the assembly make the pastoral letter of the, I guess that's four words, that the assembly make the pastoral letter of the partial report of the ad interim committee on Christian nationalism available to all sessions, presbyteries, and interested parties for their consideration and use. There is a second. I'd like to speak.
I believe it's been seconded. You may speak to that.
Sure. I want to express my gratitude to the committee. I never anticipated you'd be able to even pull off what you have so far, and I think it is very well done. Obviously, as the chair has already indicated, there's some maybe inconsistencies in the report still, or some errors, and there's still a variety of views. My speech and motion is not to challenge any of those things, but to simply say it's my understanding that this is going to come, or the desire is for it to come next year to be adopted. And so when you adopt something, that is the position of the PCA. It's not constitutional, but it's our statement and position on a thing. By sending this down to the presbyteries now, it's a de facto adoption because it has instructions and guidelines and guidance for presbyteries to follow, that if they follow it and we disagree with it a year from now, we've given them bad guidance. And so I want to move that the pastoral letter, which I think deals with a number of the concerns, be sent to the presbyteries, recognize that we have received the report. It is available to everybody to read, but I would not want to give the impression that the assembly is approving of or adopting it when we have not had that debate yet. That's my argument.
All right, so that's a substitute motion. Mr. Sayer, have you emailed that to the clerks, or maybe you could bring that up here?
I can bring it up. I have not emailed it.
It'd be helpful for us to have the actual language to make sure that the court gets exactly the motion correctly. So let's deal with the amendment that's before us, that the assembly may make the pastoral letter of the partial report of the ad interim committee on Christian nationalism available to all sessions, presbyteries, and interested parties for their considerations and use. This has been described as a strike and add amendment. So that's what we're going to do. I think what we're going to do is, rather than do clickorama, I think we're going to get our blue cards and we're going to stand and wave. So if you are in favor of the amendment, get your blue cards. Yes would be stand at this time with the blue card. All right, you may sit. No would be stand. If everyone would get their clickers, please. Voting is now closed. The motion to amend recommendation one fails.
It failed 55-45, something like that. Whatever. So it did not become the main, and it didn't. My motion did not carry, and they sent this report down. And sure enough, within a day, I think it's the Tennessean reported that major U.S. denomination denounces Christian nationalism, and we're the first ones to do that. And that's not what the report said at all, but this is the risk of voting to essentially approve sending this down, is it gives the impression that we actually did something that we didn't do. And then furthermore, the report that we do have doesn't say anything about denouncing Christian nationalism whatsoever. It doesn't even denounce establishmentarian views. But anyway, so this report is punted till next year. And I don't know how it will be, quote unquote, used in the interim. But we know that there's some issues with it at this point. And also, I just want to reiterate, I mean, I do have gratitude for all these guys. A couple of them I consider personal friends, and my issues with it have nothing to do with the men or the good work that they did. I just don't think it's ready. So we did three of the things. We did M&A, we did the Director of Worship, we did the Christian Nationalism Report, functional female officers. This one brings up and raises a number of issues, unfortunately. And there were 10 overtures dealing with ordaining or functionally putting women in positions of office. So either on one extreme, it was to actually allow women to be ordained to the office of deacon. That one failed handily. Like it wasn't even close. And but others were dealing with various aspects of women being placed in positions of what people are calling functional female officers. They're put in positions that look like they're an officer of the church, that function as their officers in the church, that are doing the duties of officers in church, but they're not calling them officers, or at least they don't have the formal procedure to make them officers. So they're allowed to exist in this maybe limbo area. And to be sure, some doing this and it's more extreme, and others are probably not doing anything wrong, but it's getting lumped into this. And like I said, there were 10 of these overtures. This was the debate coming into the assembly. And quite frankly, the whole overture to actually ordain women as deacons came in after the debate around functional female officers. And I really think it took everybody's eye off the ball, because it was never going to pass. Of course, we're going to fail that. I don't view it as a paper win or a significant win to reaffirm by vote exactly what we have always believed and everybody still believes. When I say everybody, I mean, again, I don't know how many votes were against it, but it wasn't even close. And so that win took our eye off of the issue that the PC was actually dealing with. And then what happened is 8 of the overtures that were dealing with all different aspects of this were answered in reference to that one. So this is part of the polity stuff. If you deal with one overture and the other ones are doing something similar or trying to, you could just say that's the answer. Well, what's unfortunate about that is the answer is the answer, not the rationale. And what I mean by that is that answer was answered no, we will not ordain women deacons. So that means every other overture was answered no. Now, the rationale for why we won't ordain women deacons is because ordination is, officers can only be male. That's our belief as the PCA. And then, so I said there was 10 overtures. One was answered no, we won't have women deacons. All the ones trying to forbid or deal with creating ecclesiastical bodies that function like officers, all those were referred to that, which means those were no. And then the last one was that the names of officers in the session, so the elders and the diaconate, the deacons, need to be in the minutes. Once they're in the minutes, you know, becomes a part that will be a part of review and control. I think it must have to be in the presbytery minutes. So that way our PR would end up eventually seeing them. But maybe I'm wrong on that. So that actually passed. So we said no to something we always would say no to. And then everything else that we need to debate and dialogue, there was no desire to do that. And that's the assembly's right to have that position. I think what's unfortunate about this is, and I actually had people come up to me, and I know sometimes we say that and you want, no, this, I'm not lying. I had a number of people come up to me and be frustrated over this, saying, you know, this they came here to debate and discuss these things. And in some case, they're ruling elders who, you know, the whole thing, they take time off and a lot of it comes out of their pocket and all this other stuff. And nothing is being discussed. Everything's just getting punted, you know? And it really started in overtures. Now, the overtures committee had 90 overtures, way too many to deal with. And so somebody dubbed it the Novatures. They just either voted no or they kicked things back to the presbyteries, referred them back to the presbyteries, because quite frankly, it could take an hour to edit one overture. So you don't have that kind of time. Maybe the idea is teach the presbyteries and the individuals lessons so that next year we have a manageable load, you know? But what happened was after, I think it was overture 32, I don't know the numbers, or 37, forbidding, you know, women deacons as officers, a group of overtures were grouped into a motion. I wasn't in the room because I was in the administrative committee and watching the M&A committee also. But my understanding is there was a motion to group them and to refer them all to this. And so if a motion is on the floor, one person can't pull an overture out. And so that was a lot of miscommunication or misunderstanding. And people said, well, now we can never pull them out because they were grouped. And I was saying, well, even if that's what you did in overtures, a motion was made to group them. When it comes to the floor, anybody can pull them out because on the floor, it's an omnibus. And when things are tried to take in gross or in omnibus, anybody can say, I don't want number 52 in the omnibus, pull it out. And so that's what happened. But in overtures, they couldn't pull it out of the grouping and there wasn't enough for a minority report. And this is what I suspect happened because I know who was in the room. I genuinely believe there was enough for a minority report, but the pressure of the room, and this is not a nefarious thing. This is what happens when you're in, is the energy wasn't there. The view wasn't there. The pressure, there was pressure there just by virtue of what was happening that there wasn't enough guys that were willing to go out and say, we'll do a minority report on this. So when it came to the floor of the assembly, I think Stephen O'Neill, a teaching elder, pulled it out. I think two of them were pulled out. And the one Stephen pulled out was against creating other ecclesiastical bodies, meaning, you know, not create. And it was a great rationale. I think it came out of even David Strain's presbytery. Maybe he was the author. And so he pulled it out, which means we discuss it. Now, the debate before this going on is, well, there's no point in that because it's already the motion from overtures is to refer it to a no. So it's a no. So if we overrule overtures, when you overrule overtures, a no doesn't become yes. It simply just kind of exists there. And then the overtures has to deal with it, either go back into session or deal with it the next year. My argument, not on the floor, but as we were, you know, debating this amongst people, is, well, that I think that's what has to happen, because here's the problem. Whenever things are dealt with like this and you try to bring it back in a future year, the argument in the future is, we already dealt with that. And I guarantee that's what will be said if it comes back next year. We already dealt with that. But the thing is, it wasn't dealt with. And there was a lot of energy on the floor of people feeling like it wasn't dealt with. And I would almost say, and I don't have a crystal ball or anything like that, but like that we would have gotten 51% on the right one. But the fear is, and you heard this even like with Mel Duncan on Ryan Beasy's podcast, if you listen to his analysis of it, now he was the moderator, so he didn't have a say, but his feeling was they would never pass 2/3 of the presbyteries, because that's what has to happen. But the reason I thought if we could overrule, well, again, it wouldn't even go to the presbyteries because it doesn't go from a no to a yes, but it would send the message that, no, we haven't dealt with it. Because people say, well, what's the difference? It doesn't make it a yes. Well, it makes it not a no. I mean, this is like basic stuff. Like, it might not make it a yes, but it doesn't make it a no. Right now it's a no. And when you go to bring anything similar next year, they're going to say we dealt with it. But anyway, look, we all have a vote. We all have a say. We all have rights. But also those who are doing the working the process, you know, they're the ones kind of directing this thing. So it was, there were three ways it was kind of prohibited. Was first, it was grouped in overtures and guys tried to pull it out of the group and they didn't have the number. You need majority to do that. They didn't have enough numbers for a minority report. I think they might have needed only a couple more guys. And there were guys of that persuasion, but the pressure in the room was not to do that. When it came to the floor of the assembly, it did get pulled out of the omnibus, but immediately by a very good friend of mine, and I still love him and I respect his view on this and whatever else, but called the question before the person who pulled it out, who was at a mic at the exact same time, could speak to it. Now, I wasn't in a position to run up to a mic and, you know, call a point of order and just raise that concern to the moderator. I do understand when you're up there looking at all the lights, it's hard to see who's first. But I will say Mel Duncan, another friend, he was the moderator and he navigated this whole assembly just beautifully. But when that had happened in the past in the assembly where somebody calls the question and somebody else at the mic at the same time, he deferred to the other person at the mic before going back. Because I will say this assembly, there wasn't a whole bunch of people at mics. It wasn't like that. And so I wish I had ran up to a mic or stood up and I didn't and just called a point of order and said, you know, Mr. Moderator, there's only one other person at the mic. He was there at the same time as the individual calling the question. And this is the person who pulled this overture out. He deserves a right to speak to why he pulled it out. And then you can go to the person who called the question. But that was a moot point. And once again, clearly the pressure in the hall was, we just don't even want to deal with this. There is a real desire among conservatives, it seems like, or a growing one, confessional men, that things that are not going to pass the two-thirds threshold of presbyteries, and we saw this with all the side B stuff, like it takes years and years and you don't get it through. You don't get it through two-thirds of the presbyteries. And so you get a sort of compromised thing through, once again, because we're big tent. And so I think the compromise here is the fact that people have to put their officers, their elders and deacons in the minutes, and those are observable to the denomination. And that leaves, you know, men who want to have the dialogue and debate frustrated. They make the trip. They think this is what it's about. It's kind of like, you know, General Assembly takes on a life of its own. It's kind of billed as this is the functional female officer General Assembly. And it wasn't. And you know, again, that was the will of the assembly. And this goes back to my, this is the status quo Big Tent assembly. This was a year where it had the potential of going into Friday. It had the potential of getting heated. And for the most part, there was unity and peace, which is what the Lord wants for his church. Now, what that means for the PCA, I think, there's maybe a growing recognition that we are actually a Big Tent denomination and our polity doesn't actually have a way to deal with or a way to change things drastically. And some people would say that's a feature, not a bug. Some would say that because you need two-thirds of presbyteries to vote on things and you don't get that. And here's the deal with the two-thirds of things. It's not that, like, if you're in the majority, that those voting in the minority are like, wrong for voting that way for the reasons you think. Some people don't vote on things on just on principle. I don't want to put that in the BCO. They agree with it fully and they don't want it there. Other people say, well, I kind of agree with this, but I'm worried about the slippery slope of what the next thing will be and how, like, so there's all kinds of reasons this doesn't work. And this goes to what I've said before, that the PCA is going to, I think, increasingly polarize at the presbytery level, but unify at the assembly level. And what I mean about that is you're going to have progressive in the Brian Chappell sense of the word. He published it, defined it. It exists in the PCA. And I don't know why anybody should be offended about the word. You're going to have presbyteries that are operate in more progressive ways and are just like it. When people say, well, take it to their presbytery, it's happening in the presbytery because the presbytery already allows it. And the SJC defers to the press secretary's explanation of why they're allowing something unless it's like completely grossly constitutional. They defer to the lower court. And you're going to have confessional conservative presbyteries that don't allow those things or men in their presbytery who want to do those things. And so you're going to have presbyteries growing increasingly conservative and increasingly progressive within the bounds that are already there. That's just what I think is happening. And then I think this assembly kind of reflected that. I think we had a, you know, and look, we need years of peace. I don't know what that'll mean for next year. I don't know if the functional female officer thing will come back next year. I kind of suspect it won't. I think people are going to be watching the overture around, you know, putting names in the minutes. That'll be kind of a test the waters. But what does this mean for the PCA? Well, I think we know what the PCA is. It's a big tent reform denomination. I think that's what it is. You know, that doesn't mean there can't be reforms. That doesn't mean there should be semper reformanda, right? So how do I feel about the PCA? I love the PCA. All my friends are in the PCA. All my resources in the PCA. The PCA is the largest and best reformed denomination in the country. And so that's where, are there things I'd like to see changed? Yeah, of course. Do I wish we would reject postmodern use of language where we can call things what we want and say we're in the bounds and all that? Yeah, I wish we can call balls and strikes the same, but you know, we have different understandings of these things and it's all beyond me. So here's three issues, I think, for next General Assembly. Dialogue should not be squashed just because guys on committees make some procedural maneuver to deal with an issue. That should not trump the assembly. Now, people say, well, the will of the assembly was to call the question, or the will of the assembly was to leave it that way or whatever. Yeah, I get that. And yet when you have a strong minority of the assembly, like could be 40%, wanting to discuss something, I'm not saying like win a vote that changes something, but like wanting to have a discussion, it's a shame that particularly as we come into an assembly, that those things are squelched. The voting devices obviously are atrocious, but I reject the idea that there cannot be a technological solution to this. I mean, when I was a teacher in 2012 in schools, we had phone apps that we would give kids so they can use their phones, because you're battling like how do you keep kids off their phones in school and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, if you can't beat them, join them. So we could have questions on the board with an app hooked like a master app, and the kids would have that app on their phone, but they'd have an authorization key that would key it to what we're doing. And real time, I could do a math question and say, you know, give me your answers, and they would real time show there. There'd be graphs. This was 2012. So it's 2026. This is not new technology. Now, how that works with geo tracking in a conference hall and make it, obviously, but there's nothing to stop somebody from giving their clicker to a friend and saying, vote the way, you know, I'm going to dinner, go vote. You know, we're elders. We have to have integrity and do this right. And so the whole like, well, somebody should develop an app. And then somebody else saying, well, I heard somebody is developing an app. Folks, the technology has been available for well over a decade, if not a decade and a half. So I know the AC will be working on this, and I actually feel bad for the company that was with the voting devices. I don't think it was their fault either. Like, we are using technology that is not made for the size of the hall that we're in and for the number of votes coming in and the frequency of the votes coming in. You know, this is not a homeowners association with a couple hundred votes and you can wait 5 minutes for the tally. Where we probably vote on 100 things in the assembly. We can't wait. We need instantaneous results, and there's ways to do it. I actually came up with a great idea. And so basically, and this will help the AC fund the assembly. If you're going to vote, you have to bring singles, dollar bills. And so everybody's got to bring like 50 of them, right? And then what you do is you have three money counters up there. And you have yes is one money counter, And no is one money counter, and abstain is one money counter. And if you want, have two of each, whatever. And basically, if you're yes, you put your bill in that money counter. And if you're no, you put, and they can actually have floor clerks coming around, and you can have yes floor clerks and no floor clerks, and they can count them. And we're trusting floor clerks with the counts anyway. And so, I mean, like, you know, in the movies, they stick $100,000 in a money counter and it spits it out in like, you know, less than a minute. And so I think we could do it that way. And then the AC would make a lot of money for the assembly. Kidding aside, it is a joke, but it's not. There's ways to do this, and I know they're going to be working on it. The last thing is, I was on the AC, and they had a vote to make the ruling elder fee the same as the teaching elder fee. Now, we had just changed this maybe 2 or 3 years ago and gave the ruling elders a break. And they said, well, there was, you know, a little bump. They kept saying there was no bump, but there's a little bump in ruling elder participation, but it didn't have the effect we thought. And so we're just going to make it the same price for ruling and teaching elders. I actually don't have an opinion on that one way or the other, because the church is supposed to be paying anyway. Now, I will say, functionally, churches often have budgets, and they may say we can only send one person. And in that case, they're going to send their pastor. Or maybe say we can send two people and they have two pastors. You would hope they would send a ruling elder and a teaching elder. But they probably don't. And maybe if it was cheaper for a teaching elder, I don't know. And then the other thing is they raised the price for next year to $600 or more, maybe $650. I forget, maybe $625. And when people objected to both the change for the ruling elder and the money raise, they kept saying, well, this is a small percentage of the overall cost to go to the assembly. Now, I will differ in the idea that it's a small percentage. It is a smaller percentage, certainly, than the room cost, but maybe or maybe not. I mean, there's three major costs, maybe four. There's the registration fee, there's the travel fee, whether it's a rental car, your own car, gas, or a flight. There's the hotel fee, and then there's the food, the meals fee. So there's four costs. And yes, while a room might be $1,000 for a single individual, many people share rooms, and that brings it down to, you know, $400 or $500 for the room. I know of an Airbnb that cost each guy $150. So the registration fee of $600 is not a small percentage of the rest of the cost when a guy is getting a room for $150, or when they're just driving from 2 hours away and their travel cost isn't much. So I didn't like the narrative around it's just a small percentage. That only factors in the people who are far away, flying and staying single person in the best hotel there. Then yeah, I agree. Their hotel can be like $1,200. You're in the maybe another $600-$800 for flight and rental car and everything else you want to do. But the point is adding $100 is not supposedly going to break the bank. And I agree with that, but there is a psychological thing to it. It triggers in the mind that this is an expensive thing because of that. You know, in other words, when sessions are looking in their budgets, they're seeing the registration fee, and that psychologically affects how you view sending people to the assembly. And, you know, I stood up in the AC and I tried to have a different way of thinking about this. And some people appreciated it. Nobody didn't appreciate it, but it didn't really do anything. Because I voted against it. I voted against the raising of the fee because for two reasons. One, if we're going to have a problem in Milwaukee, it's not going to be because we didn't raise the fee $100. It's going to be because only 1,500 people show up and the assembly needs over 2,000 to pay for it. But the bigger issue to me is it's just completely linear math. It's like the convention costs this much, we have this many commissioners, so divide it and that's how much it's going to cost. And, you know, this is not a conference. It's not a convention. It's the business of the church. And, you know, what we have is a pay to play situation. That's what this is. If you want to vote, you have to pay. Now people say, well, the churches pay. Yeah. And that's the Lord's money. And, you know, like at Meadowview, we used to budget $10,000 for General Assembly because I just had a strong conviction. I think I had it doubled with the session. You know, I got it, you know, the session voted on it, but because I thought we should need to send our full complement. But as soon as budgets got tight, that was the first thing that people wanted to cut, you know, how many people we can send. And we had three pastors. We usually send two because we usually leave a pastor back at the church. And then we'd send two teaching elder, ruling elders, and sometimes more. They'd go as observers, but they, you know, share a room or something. But my point is, this is not a conference. This is not a convention, as fun as it is. And I love all those things about it. This is the business of the church. And I don't think it should be costing us to place votes in the church. Now, in a very real way, I actually do have to pay because as a missionary, I don't have a church paying for me. It's coming out of my budget, and my budget is how I'm paid. And that goes for every MTW missionary, probably every church planner, every RUF guy. And I know there's a lot of people that don't want us voting anyway. So whatever. But all that to say is I spoke to pastors who are in some of the larger churches in our denomination, and they run very large conferences for organizations, and they can't believe how low our sponsorship money is, both in, you know, what we charge exhibitors, and there's always the fear that you won't get those exhibitors, but just the idea of being a gold level sponsor. So forget the booth part of it. You have to make that so that vendors will come, but we just don't have the sponsorships that, like, the General Assembly is about $1 million. Now, some of you are thinking, whoa, that's a lot of money. And others of you are thinking like me, no, that's not for what we are and what we do. $1 million isn't a lot. Like, why can't we have $1 million raised specifically for this? How does the SBC, who has, is it 12,000 or 14,000 commissioners? They call them messengers, SBC messengers. Their convention is free to those messengers. They just have to pay for their travel accommodations. And I think they have like 25,000 visitors there also. So they have to be able to accommodate them with workshops and all that stuff, 100% free. Now, maybe they have scale, but I don't know. I think we can do it. And so I'm saying this as kind of a call to the administrative committee and to anybody that's listening, let us look for better ways to fund this than to keeping. Otherwise, it's going to be $1,000 pretty soon. I mean, I know we don't raise the rates all that often, but they have been getting raised lately. And why not have it fully sponsored? Why not have it so that, you know, now there are some people that don't want a larger General Assembly. They want a smaller General Assembly. And they want a delegated assembly. And I think we have the best of both. We have committees of commissioners. We have overtures committees and RPRs and nominating committees and all this other sort of delegated work that packages it. So the assembly, like, why wouldn't we want more participation at the assembly level? And so that's kind of my call for this, that maybe we would think outside the box to fund the assembly for the future, that we would not be squashing General Assembly debate on big things that people came to debate just because other groups packaged it for us. And that we vote with dollar bills. No, I'm kidding. It was great being with everybody. I hope to see everybody next year. I mean, I see most people I would normally see at other conferences or whatever, but I hope to see everybody next year in Milwaukee. So I'm Pastor George for Grace at the Gates. Thanks for watching. And just a shout out to Birmingham Theological Seminary, the sponsor of this show. They had a great booth with, I think it was an owl stuffed animal for Howard Eyrick, the legendary biblical counseling professor, taught all over the PCA, actually. Doing great work there. Check them out. The fall's almost coming. You might want to get a doctor of ministry. They can get you in if you want to just take extra classes or study or, you know, get your MDiv even. BTS.education. ask for Dave Latham, or just go ahead and ask for Ike. He'll love to talk to you. I'm Pastor George for the Grace of the Gates. Thanks.